If you were interrogating a suspected terrorist, or someone who had been the driver for a known terrorist, and you wanted to get information from him, how far would you go to break down his resistance? Let's rule out unmistakable torture, no beating, burning, flaying, dismemberment. Let's agree that all of that is out of bounds. So what then should be in bounds? Reasoned verbal persuasion? Realistic threats? Exaggerated threats? Sleep deprivation? Physical discomfort? Inflicting pain? Where do we draw the line between interrogation techniques that are unpleasant but justified and those that we just cannot reconcile with our sense of being civilized? Those are questions that Joseph Lelleveld addressed in an article in yesterday's New York Times Sunday magazine called Interrogating Ourselves. And Mr. Lelleveld is in our New York bureau. Welcome to the program.
Great to be here. Thank you.
First, from what you found in your reporting for this article, is there in the U.S. today any understood standard for what U.S. interrogators do regard as acceptable?
I think there must be, but we don't know what it is, and I think it probably varies from organization to organization. It's probably somewhat stricter in the military, Abu Ghraib prison notwithstanding, than it is with the CIA. I think it's a sliding scale. But the truth is, our leaders don't speak directly on this subject for good reason. They speak euphemistically, and we have to interpret their meanings between the lines.
To what degree do you regard this as a pragmatic matter? That is, if we knew that we could rely on, say, the application of electric shock to make anyone talk and to speak honestly, and we faced conspiracies assembling dirty bombs to be placed in our cities, would you say, given the size of the threat and the efficacy of the technique, it's okay, or should there be absolute moral boundaries which say you can never do that to a person?
Personally, I incline to absolute moral boundaries. But one of the difficulties in thinking about this and talking about this is that we know very little about how effective these techniques are in harvesting reliable information. I think electric shock probably goes beyond the line of reliability. I've known people who in South Africa, where I reported long ago, who were subjected to electric shock torture, and they uniformly say, you'll say anything to get that to stop. Well, a person who's prepared to say anything can't be trusted.
Another technique that you mentioned in your article, waterboarding. What is it, and is it torture?
Well, there are various ways of doing it, but it gives the subject the impression that he's drowning. And the head of the CIA, Mr. Goss, described it as a professional interrogation technique. I personally would consider it torture.
And therefore, it's something that you could say safely would be out of bounds, even if one might uncover some massive airplane plot by doing it.
Well, that's a tough one. Might is the trick word there. In advance, you never know what you're going to uncover. And the likelihood is that if you start torturing people, you're going to torture a lot of people who don't have the information you're looking for until you begin to find the people who have some of the information you're looking for. So you get fragments here and you get fragments there, and you misfire a lot of times. How do you feel about torturing innocent people in the hope that you'll get something? That's not an easy question, and I don't know enough about what they actually get out of these sessions or how high and dry they'd be without them to make what you call a pragmatic answer.
Mm-hmm. You interviewed a number of people who've been interrogators, Americans and others. First of all, how explicit about their techniques do they get when they talk to you? And how effective do they regard their various techniques?
Well, they tend to talk quite elliptically, but every now and then they drop an anecdote of a great success they've had. The better ones, and I was talking to people who were obviously very skilled at what they did, had a moral center, felt that what they were doing was necessary to save lives, and felt strongly that violence wasn't a necessary part of the formula. They wouldn't say the same thing about the threat of violence, however. Threat of violence is actually outlawed by the United Nations Convention Against Torture, but it's clearly widely used.
A lot of your article is about Israel, where the Israelis have had a very public and judicial discourse over the limits of interrogation. What have they decided?
Their Supreme Court in 1999 issued a sweeping judgment that all forms of torture and all forms of what's sometimes called torture light, or what's called in the UN Convention cruel, inhuman, and degrading treatment, were illegal in the state of Israel. That you couldn't do anything in a military interrogation room that you couldn't do in a police station. It allowed for a defense after the fact, but it declared all these things illegal. Nevertheless, under the pressure of the Second Intifada, the practices continued, clearly at a reduced rate. It's obvious that the security service is trying to observe a legal standard and be law-abiding, but it doesn't do so absolutely, and there is a kind of understanding about that.
But you actually report, though, that if one compared the standards of interrogation from the First Intifada in the late 80s, I guess, early 90s, and the Second Intifada after 2000, there's some difference.
Yes, much more restraint, much less use of physical force, and more reliance on technological means, and more reliance on prison stool pigeons. It's still an unequal contest, but it's done with great discipline and skill, no doubt about it. It's also not infrequently in violation of the law.
Well, Mr. Lelleveld, thank you very much for talking with us today.
Glad to be here.
Joseph Lelleveld wrote the article Interrogating Ourselves for yesterday's New York Times Sunday Magazine. He spoke to us from our bureau in New York.